Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 28th of April, and we're going to do our All Things Political segment this Tuesday. Craig Gilbert, our guest, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Senator Hillary Clinton has a big new supporter today, North Carolina Governor Mike Easley has endorsed her. We'll also be talking about the Reverend Wright. And we will be talking about all kinds of other things that you will bring up this hour. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I was interested in Bob Herbert's column today in the New York Times, in which he says the Reverend Wright went to Washington on Monday not to praise Barack Obama, but to bury him. Smiling, cracking corny jokes, mugging it up for the big-time news media, this reverend is never going away. He's found himself a national platform, and he is loving it. He's living a narcissist's dream. At long last, his 15 minutes have arrived. We have to start with Reverend Wright, but he is all over the place, and so I think we probably will start there before we get into other subjects. Craig Gilbert, hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. So what is it with this guy? He's everywhere all of a sudden, just what the Obama camp doesn't want. And here's Reverend Wright writing a book. And, of course, the press isn't going to let him go.
Probably not. Probably not. You know, on one level, you can't blame the guy for wanting to, say his piece after everything has happened. But he's obviously not doing Senator Obama any favors. And... Yeah, I guess that from a political point of view, the question is, how long all this lingers.
Right.
Think about all the things that have happened in this campaign. Some of them have a shelf life, and some of them don't. This one's had a shelf life because if you go back to the original controversy, I mean, it's really been with the campaign for a long time. It hit critical mass a while back, and now it's come back. And it'll come back in the general election if Obama's the nominee.
Yeah.
I think right now it's sort of hard to step back and say exactly how much it hurts Obama under all those scenarios. I think it's like a lot of things in this campaign. You know, it's inevitable that these candidates are going to go through bumps and crises, and it's really more about how they handle them than it is about whether they occur or not.
Right. So what do you think Obama should do about Wright? Should he disconnect himself? Should he say, this is it with him, I disown him? Or how in the world does he handle it?
Well, I don't know how much more he can do at this point. Yeah. I mean, he obviously gave his speech and distanced himself but didn't disown him. Whether he needs to go a step further than that now, I don't know. I think they're hoping that... to make a little bit of lemonade out of the lemons here by pointing out that Wright is obviously acting on his own, not in concert with Obama, and hoping that creates distance.
Right.
At this point, what more can I do? What more can I say? I mean, he's his own man.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's their hope. And I do think, I'm not entirely sure what more could happen to keep the story at center stage. I mean, you had the speech in Philadelphia by Obama that put it back on center stage. You had this sort of Wright, coming out tour. And once the dust settled from his appearance at the press club yesterday and the other things he's done, days, the interview he's given, I guess the question is what more is going to give this thing light in the media and whether, we move on to something else.
Yeah, so you think that we might just move on to something else?
Well, we will move on to something else. There's no doubt about that. I mean, there's no question about that. That always happens. It does happen. I mean, the rest of the campaign is not going to be about this. That's just the way things work.
Right. What about this report about Senator Clinton supporting gas tax decrease elimination during the summer. Obama is not. Is that resonating with the American people that we want that gas tax gone for a few months?
I don't know. It's a case where Senator Clinton is taking a position that, on paper, in some respects, is closer to Senator McCain's than to Senator Obama's. That can be a double-edged sword for her. I mean, she's running for the Democratic nomination. It may be something that she feels works with some of the voters she's trying to appeal to, voters that are stressed by the economy. So it kind of fits into that piece of her agenda. You know, maybe there are some voters who think who don't like the fact that Senator Clinton is sort of coming at Obama in some cases from the right, and these are Democratic primary voters I'm talking about, so they might be a little bothered by this as well. I don't know if this is the kind of issue that's a driving issue Democratic primary, but again, it gets back to which group of voters we're talking about. And, every time this primary schedule, we're seeing the landscape changes pretty dramatically from state to state.
Right.
And so we're not always talking about the same group of voters.
Isn't that true, Craig? It changes so dramatically from state to state.
Yeah, it is. And one of the questions, I mean, it's sort of an academic question or a question for political junkies as we sort of chart the ups downs of this race is, it's very tempting in some respects to look at those ups and downs as twists and turns over time, trends, reactions, ups and downs, and that's one way of explaining them. But the other way of explaining them is just as you move from one venue to another, the demographics change, the electorate changes, and that by itself explains a lot of the different outcomes without having to talk about, actual movement in time over an attitudinal changes from one week to another. I mean, you go from one state to another and you can predict probably 90-95%, maybe in some of these states, of the outcome by simply looking at, is it an open primary? Is it a closed primary? And B, what's the demographics of the state?
Right.
And that explains an awful lot of it.
Yeah. And what about the chances of either of the candidates moving into the other's demographics?
Well, it's happened on occasion. I mean, Wisconsin is a classic example where it happened to Obama's favor. And in Pennsylvania, it even happened a little bit to Hillary's favor because she eroded some of his advantage in some of the white, upper middle class suburbs. So it hasn't happened, for example, with the African American vote, which has been rock solid with Obama, and in some states it's been, even more overwhelming than in other states. But again, it's part of this battle has been Obama trying to hold down her margin among older white voters, among blue collar white voters. Like I said, that Wisconsin is sort of a high water mark in that regard for Obama.
Mm-hmm.
But in Pennsylvania, we saw her hold down his margin among more educated white voters, and that was really helpful for her.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't seen, and I don't think we will see, an enduring breakthrough by either candidate. I mean, at this point, it's like the race is 90% over. So we're going to end this campaign with two candidates who each have very distinct coalitions, and we're not going to have a candidate who has really broken through into the other party's support base in a really meaningful way.
Right. They are, according to the polls that I was looking at yesterday, virtually tied in the state of Indiana. Do we have, of course, every state is, this is a crucial state,
Right.
But
right.
Is indeed Indiana the crucial state now?
Well, it's the next crucial state. It could be, it's been argued that it's, of all the states that remain, it's the closest thing to a level playing field. So that makes it, that gives it more importance. It's big. It's big in terms of if he wins both North Carolina and Indiana, then I think, the momentum obviously swings back to him and the pressure builds on her to get out. Carolina and she wins Indiana, we're kind of, in many respects, where we are today in terms of no quick outcome. And then if she wins both, that would be a huge shocker. And
right.
It would be, really give her a ton of momentum, and it would really reinforce all the doubts and questions that are emerging about, you know, his ability in the fall to be a strong nominee.
But it would still then have to depend on the superdelegates,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, even then, it's not like it knocked him out of the race. It just complicates things immensely and gives her, it turns her from kind of a long shot into something more realistic.
Right.
And, you know, again, it's if your interest is purely from the vantage point of kind of neutral elders in the party, it's a nightmare because they want a quick outcome.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine this race settled by the superdelegates. I can't imagine a lot of people being absolutely outraged.
Well, it has to be settled by the superdelegates on one level. I guess it depends on what you mean. I mean, if you mean the superdelegates overturning
right.
his lead among the pledged delegates, but what if his lead is 30 as opposed to 150?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a significant enough cushion, you know, a really marginal lead when you think about all the pledged delegates? I mean, it would be, you know, what if he's got, you know, 1950 and she has 1920? Then you make the case that it would be illegitimate for the superdelegates to make up that margin if they really believe that she's more electable in the fall. I mean, that's a harder case to make. Again, there's sort of the merits when you talk to get into this sort of process issue, and then there's perception. And again, what the party wants to avoid is either candidates, supporters, you know, coming out of this embittered and with a strong sense of grievance and injustice about
right.
the result. And that, you know, under some scenarios, that's probably unavoidable because if you have essentially a jump ball and a tie, it's got to go to somebody. And nobody's
mm-hmm.
going to be happy with the outcome.
Yeah. We're going to pause for a moment and get you on a better phone line, Craig, because it's a little shaky. So we want to be able to assure that we can hear you clearly, and then we will go to our phone callers. We have one line open if you'd like to speak with Craig. We're doing all things political today. Craig Gilbert is the Washington correspondent for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He has been covering politics for a good long time, and we're looking at, you know, all the issues, all the many, many, many issues. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Email, if you want to send one, is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Just a reminder that we're bringing Ira Flatow, who's host of Talk of the Nation Science Friday, to Milwaukee on May 16 for a national broadcast of his program. And you can join us at the Milwaukee Public Museum on May 16 from 1 until 3 for the program and stay for the reception to meet him and members of the Science Friday team. Tickets include admission to the museum, to the radio broadcasts, and also to a reception. And then there will be a ticketed VIP dinner with Ira Flatow, and WPR hosts will be there. I'll be there, Joy Cardine, Ben Marins. This will be at Mater's Restaurant in downtown Milwaukee starting at 5:30. So, for information, go to our website at WPR.org/Ira. Or for tickets, call 414-227-2047. That's 414-227-2047. To calls for Craig in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, the second hour of our program is Tuesday. The author of The Bear Went Over the Mountain, Finding America, Finding Myself. Our guest set out in an RV for 9 months to visit all the grave sites of the presidents and vice presidents of the United States. Craig Gilbert is our guest. We go to phone calls now, and let's go to Karen from Platteville first. Hi, Karen.
What do you think the Supreme Court decision on requiring voter ID, picture ID, will have on the remaining primaries and on the general election, and who will it favor and so forth?
Well, I don't think it'll have any impact on the remaining primaries. I mean, all it does mean that in states that require photo ID, that those laws will be intact. There aren't that many states that have laws like Indiana's. Most of them are, ask for photo IDs, but give you the ability to sign an affidavit if you don't have a photo ID, or you can provide some other form of identification. And so by the same token, it may not have a major effect in the fall, because if you look at the battleground states, the states where this could really have an impact in a close race, there aren't too many places where this is going to come into play. But it could have an impact in the longer term if some of these states do adopt the legislation. I mean, there's obviously nothing that compels a state to go with photo ID. This just removes a potential legal barrier. And so in a state like Wisconsin, which arguably is a state where it could have an impact in a very close race like we've had the last two cycles, it's going to depend on what happens legislatively. And you've got the governor, obviously, that vetoed this before. And so the prospects of passing this are probably better handicapped by one of our legislative reporters, but I'm not sure we're likely to see that in Wisconsin in the immediate future.
Hmm. What do you think, Karen?
I don't know. I just hope we do have an election like we haven't had since 1996 for president. I mean, one that really counted
mm-hmm.
for the American people and the voter.
Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Frank from Madison, hi.
Hello. I would like to point out that in the last 2 weeks there have been really significant revelations that seem to have been not completely, but largely ignored by the media. And instead, we're fascinated by the Reverend Wright and the struggle between Obama and Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, first, that the GAO had a report on the war on terror and found that there wasn't one, that there are no coherent plans to deal with al-Qaeda, and that there were, and quite specifically, that in Afghanistan, there was no coordinated effort to confront al-Qaeda and find Osama bin Laden. So the war on terror may have justified the attack on Iraq, but dealing with terrorists was not what it was about. And then the second thing is that there was a revelation that at the highest levels, the United States decided to ignore international law and institute a regime of torture. And the people who were involved in that decision have been named and are refusing to be held accountable. They're not even responding to requests from Congress to testify as to what happened. So I think the Reverend Wright may be entertaining, but there are other major principles that have been violated, and we're not paying attention. So thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Craig.
Yeah, I think as a general matter, I mean, there's a lot of things that are not on the front page right now because of the Clinton-Obama race being unresolved. And, you know, the debate in a lot of ways is going to shift dramatically once the Democratic race is over, because then you're going to have a debate not between two Democrats who take mostly the same positions on issues but have, you know, different styles, different appeals, different backgrounds, different rhetorical themes. Then you're going to have, once this race is resolved, you're going to have a race against between a Republican and a Democrat with very different views. And that is going to really, pretty dramatically alter the debate. It's going to alter the coverage. It's going to be very different discussion and conversation. And it's going to be certainly more substantive in the sense of major policy differences are going to be back on the table. And then I think that's going to open the door for more of the kind of debate that the caller is talking about, where we're debating, the legacies of the Bush administration, but also debating the agenda ahead on the home front and in terms of foreign policy. And that'll be a pretty rich debate.
You know, I think one of the debates that hasn't been as extensive as it needs to be, and maybe nobody has a complete answer, Craig, but the whole economy is just going down the tubes here, and got this huge hunger crisis all over the world, and the gasoline prices have to be affecting people enormously, the increased cost of food. There just have to be so many people hurting right now.
Yeah, and I think the expectation is that that will dominate the conversation.
Yes.
For the rest of the year, unless something happens on the foreign policy front that puts that back to center stage. And obviously, the foreign, you know, Iraq is also going to be part of the conversation, mm-hmm. too, in a general election campaign. But, yeah, that's a lot of what this is going to be about. I mean, we had, you know, if you go back 4 years ago, there were ads, you know, there was a debate about the economy. There were ads run. The Bush campaign ran ads about gas taxes, attacking John Kerry for allegedly supporting a 50-cent increase in the gas tax. So that was part of the discussion back then, but I think it's a bigger part of the discussion this time around.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, I think it's going to be a different kind of campaign.
Mm-hmm. And do you see for many of the candidates a pretty complete program that the American public is going to get excited about?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, there's going to be differences, certainly. And we know what a lot of them are. I mean, there's differences on taxes. There's going to be differences on spending. There's going to be differences on economic policy. And some of those differences are pretty familiar. But to the extent that John McCain, for example, isn't an entirely traditional Republican candidate, it kind of remains to be seen how much different that debate is going to be than it would have been 4 years ago or 8 years ago,
mm-hmm.
Particularly 4 years ago. Because 8 years ago, George Bush wasn't necessarily running as a traditional Republican candidate either. But John McCain, you know, obviously has had his differences with the Bush administration in some areas, and he says and has said that a lot of rhetoric about believing there's a role for government, and he's clearly been more open to government more activist policy, federal policies in some respects on the domestic front than President Bush, but he's also been kind of a crusader against spending.
Right.
And so how he kind of resolves those things and how he frames his economic agenda on things like health care and the mortgage crisis, this already, where it's kind of been, there's been some suspense as to what degree he's going to embrace more activist policies. That's going to be one of the more interesting things to watch in this campaign, because he's under pressure from his right not to do that, but in this environment, you know, I think he feels compelled in a general election campaign to offer some more activist solutions. Given the state of the economy and given also the unpopularity of the Bush administration.
Yeah. Let's go to Aaron from Manitowoc. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the Republican Party has pretty much got their vote on John McCain. I'm just wondering if there is a way that the Republicans could be voting in on the Democratic vote, or, you know, going in and kind of messing up the way the whole Democratic Party is going right now by voting.
About Republicans, you know, mischief votes in the primaries?
Excuse me?
You mean Republicans kind of creating mischief by voting in the Democratic primaries?
Yeah. Yeah, if there's any way that they could be doing it. I was talking with my dad about it, and he had brought up that comment once.
Well, there's been a lot of discussion of this over the course of this race in states that have open primaries. Republicans can vote, and Pennsylvania, by the way, was a closed primary, so the only way if you're a Republican you could vote in the Pennsylvania primary was to change your registration well in advance of the primary and then vote. My feeling is that this does not happen on a large scale, and that it's very difficult to kind of separate out analytically, you know, Republicans voting for the candidate they like better on the Democratic side and Republicans voting in a way that they think, you know, elects the candidate that they want to run against or in a way that they just think creates trouble for the Democrats. I just don't think, from a behavioral standpoint, this happens on a large scale, and I think most of the people, the scholars that have looked at this don't think it happens on a large scale. It may happen around the edges.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Aaron, very much for your call. Diane is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I heard on the Lehrer News Hour, which is on PBS, that the Supreme Court ruling about having to have ID will be effective for this next election in Indiana. And therefore, many poor people who don't have time to get a certified copy of their birth certificate will not be able to get state ID in order to vote. So this will affect the next election, and Hillary will win.
Are you talking about the primary election?
Correct.
Yeah, and I don't know, I guess the question about the, I'm not sure, I think, yeah, but I think that that law is already in place in Indiana, so I think that's the status quo. According to our story in the paper today, the Indiana law was upheld by a district court and then by the U.S. appellate court in 07, so I think that means that the law is already in place, so the only thing that it would have happened had the law been overturned. Obviously, it would have not been in place. But I just don't think, I'm not sure, I don't know the answer to that question, how dramatic an impact this is likely to have in Indiana's primary. I do know that in the general election, you know, Indiana is not a battleground state, and so there's almost no scenario under which you could say that this law is going to make a difference general in Indiana.
Let's go to an email here. Let me turn my mic so I can read it. I'm glad that you've brought up the loquacious Reverend Wright. Quite honestly, even though I'm an Obama supporter, I'm glad that Reverend Wright is doing the right thing and speaking out. No doubt he's been speaking about Martin Luther King's warning of the three isms affecting American society. Racism, does Sean Bell verdict ring a bell? Consumerism, just think about the diversion of food for transportation, and militarism, the genocide perpetuated in Iraq. Of course, this does not go down well with the majority of society who would like to shun his words, and I trust that it will force Obama's hand, who shamefully has been obsequious so far in light of his reaction to Reverend Wright, the Sean Bell verdict, saying all options are on the table regarding Iran and so forth. It's very important that the presidential candidates, especially Obama's, feet be held to the fire.
Well, I think this illustrates why it's problematic for Obama, is because, you know, issues that are this contentious, divisive, controversial, whatever word you want to use, are almost, it's almost kind of a no-win situation for a candidate, because you know, when you have to, when you're put in the position of, quote, distancing yourself from an associate or an ally, then, you know, it's a pretty easy matter to alienate people on both sides of that political question, because you don't satisfy the people that you don't satisfy your critics, and you may irritate your supporters for, in their mind, you know, caving. So I think this is why it's an awkward and kind of a no-win proposition for Obama when he's this whole issue. I mean, and why he would just like it to go away.
Yeah. What do you make of North Carolina Governor Mike Easley's endorsement of Senator Clinton? Is that a big deal?
Well, you know, endorsements have had some significance in these races. I think North Carolina is a pretty difficult race for her to win because of the large African-American vote.
Mm-hmm.
This may help her hold down his margin, which does matter because, again, we're sort of fixated on who wins and who loses, but the margins are important, not just from a public relations and a perception standpoint, but because it's a race for delegates. So to whatever extent this helps her hold down his margins, that's helpful. I mean, we've seen both things. We've seen states where governors have, you know, the candidate endorsed by the governor, like Obama in Wisconsin by Governor Doyle and Clinton in Ohio, Governor Strickland, where that endorsement, you know, whether it helped or not, the candidate who got the endorsement has won. Pennsylvania, Ed Rendell. it hasn't happened everywhere. And most political scientists think endorsements tend to be a little bit more marginal in their impact. But that, you know, that may be a little bit, they may be a little bit more than that in these primaries. So good thing for her. He's a super delegate, too.
Are you still having a good time with all of this, or is it getting too old?
No, I'm enjoying it. I think you have to pace yourself, and you know it
yeah,
does
right.
it does it kind of affects the decisions you make about how often to go out on the campaign trail.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm fortunate in that I have the ability to go when I want to go and not go when I don't want to go. A lot of people who are covering this campaign are committed to being out on the road every day, and that's a good thing in some ways because it's good to be out on the road. It's good to talk to voters. It's good to, talk to the campaign on a daily basis. But it's also, you need to step back, and there are certain things you can't do and certain stories you can't do when you're locked into the day-to-day of the campaign.
Right.
And so, it's a long haul. I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for people that are doing this 24/7
mm-hmm.
travel.
Mm-hmm.
That's brutal. It's just brutal.
And it must be brutal for all these months, Craig. Holy Toledo.
It's brutal, and it's not just journalistically, it's not a recipe for great journalism either because there's a lot of monotony it just requires a tremendous amount of focus and discipline just to force yourself to listen to everything that's being said.
Mm-hmm.
Every day and every hour. But you can only, it does give you a feel, a little bit of a feel for what the candidates go through and what their staffs go through. And it's a crazy, I mean, when you think about it, you just have to marvel at the process, especially this time around. And
right.
people from reporters I know a lot of reporters in the Foreign Press Corps, and it's just, it is kind of astonishing to them. I mean, what we put our candidates through. In some ways, it's wonderful. Hold because there's something very personal and democratic and kind of grassroots about the process.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's just insane because it's such a brutal process that you have to ask yourself, is this the best possible test for a future president to be put through? But it's sort of like, it's like a long baseball season. They say in baseball that, over 162 games in the playoff series, have a weakness or a deficiency, it's gonna be exposed.
Right.
And that's true in these presidential campaigns too. I mean, we've seen it time and time again. If you have something in your background that's going to raise questions, if you have a limitation as a candidate, it is going to be exposed and it's going to be under the microscope. And unless you're a front runner who just puts your opponent away in the opening rounds of these campaigns.
Right.
And that in a way, may be a good thing because, we're less likely to be surprised down the road. But it's a pretty brutal process.
We're going to welcome more phone calls for Craig. Craig Gilbert is our guest, and we're talking politics this hour with him. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we're looking at, a whole number of issues. Reverend Wright's press tour, we're looking at the economy and how the candidates are dealing with that. We're looking at the voter ID law, which was upheld by the Supreme Court, and how that will affect the race in Indiana and subsequent races. Endorsement by North Carolina Governor Mike Easley for Senator Clinton. Her path to winning this, if there is one, and whatever you bring up. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, Milwaukee 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050, or if you'd like, send an email. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, the author of The Bear Went Over the Mountain, Finding America, Finding Myself. Our guest was 50 years old, Memorial Day weekend, buckled himself into an RV and fled to America. His idea was to visit the grave sites of all of the presidents and vice presidents, and for good measure, the 48 approximate American states. The private motive, he said, was who knows, it was as mixed as dirt. And he comes up with some profound observations about life in different parts of America and looks at all of the presidents and the vice presidents as well. So it'll be a good hour. Craig Gilbert is with us now. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 for those of you joining us in Milwaukee. Rodney from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Rodney.
Hi. I wanted to say this Gerald Wright is just a smokescreen for white people when they finally, not me for the primary, because I'm an African-American male, but for the general election, to use this or any other thing they said about Obama not to pull the lever when they finally get in there. Because, you know, we take our polls, we go, and then when it finally comes down to getting in there, it's like, can I really vote for a black man? And I heard this saying, somebody wrote, called it tolerance fatigue. You know, right now they, you know, and it's like, and we've heard that, I've heard somewhere the number was 19% of people saying, and, you know, when Hillary Clinton calls it blue-collar workers, she's meant white workers in those areas that won't vote for Obama, no matter what he does. And so, and with this other thing, with this Gerald Wright, didn't he show up at the Clinton's White House when they were in the White House? And so, I mean, this whole story is really about nothing. It's about people that wouldn't vote for him anyway, and when they do, if they did, or thinking about it, when they finally get to it, they won't, so they have an excuse.
Well, you know, it's he did show up at the Clinton White House. Obviously, he wasn't as close to the Clintons as he was to Obama. You know, the issue of race in this campaign is pretty fascinating, and it's in the eye of the beholder in a lot of ways. I mean, different people are going to have different perceptions about the role it's playing, and it is, you know, it's a challenge as journalistically to cover, because, you know, you want to you don't want to neglect its potential impact. On the other hand, you know, you don't want to attribute to people motivations that they may or may not have, and so it's very difficult to say whether someone who's voting for Senator Clinton and against, whether that person is voting against Senator Obama or voting for Senator Clinton, and B, you know, to what degree race figures into that, just as you might ask to what degree gender may figure into a vote for or against Senator Clinton. I mean, you certainly anecdotally find on the campaign trail, you can find voters who appear to be you know, reacting against Obama's race for one reason or another. You do see that. And you see there's some evidence in the polls, although it's tricky, in the exit polls, you have a certain percentage of voters that changes from state to state who are saying that they considered race a factor in their vote. So it's there. But you know, for how many people, and you know, to quantify that is hard, and it's going to be you know, even more interesting to watch, or just as interesting to watch in the general election dynamic, if Obama is the nominee.
Thank you, Rodney, so much for your call. We go to Tom from Fond du Lac. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I was just curious if your guests would know what's happened to Donald Rumsfeld. It just seems uncharacteristic that we haven't heard from him for so long.
He landed somewhere, and is he writing a book? That would make
sense.
Oh,
of course, he must be.
He must be writing a book.
Right. You know, I read something about him just the other day, and I can't remember what the heck it was.
I don't think he's going to be in the McCain administration.
Yeah, probably not. That's it, Tom, or you want to go somewhere else?
No, well, it just seems strange that, you know, that we haven't heard from anything about him for such a long time. I heard, too, that he was writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine what he would have to say.
Mm-hmm.
But,
well, anyway, he's probably going to say that he's not. It's not his fault.
Right. And what about the role of Karl Rove in the McCain campaign and in this whole campaign? Is he going to be front and center, do you think? Or?
I don't know that he's going to be front and center. I think he seems to be taking to the role of analyst. Mm-hmm. And he's actually gotten pretty good reviews across partisan lines for the analysis he's doing on Fox News on these election nights. He's also writing op-eds for the Wall Street Journal. Now, obviously, he's got his point of view, but if you read his, and, you know, it's sort of like a lot of other things, you know, people are going to read into his analysis whatever agenda they want to, but he's obviously a smart guy. He understands politics. It's to me, it's been kind of interesting to listen to him and to read him kind of handicapping the Democratic race. Mm-hmm. And even handicapping the general election. I mean, one of the comments he made on Fox News on the night of the Pennsylvania primary about the polarization in the Democratic race was it was kind of a cautionary comment to Republicans that, hey, look, you know, when the Democrats finally pick somebody, John McCain kind of understands that, you know, there's going to be a rallying effect behind that Democratic nominee, and his position in these head-to-head matchups with that Democrat is going to decline. It's going to plummet in the short term. Mm-hmm. And so, I found his analysis to be interesting to listen to. I don't know that he's going to take any more active role in the campaign than that. He obviously has, you know, made some peace with the McCain people. I have nothing about whether he is going to play a more active role than that in the McCain campaign. There certainly are some Bush people who are active in the McCain campaign.
Right. It just strikes me as that there are certain people that you get tired of. Get tired of them, you know. That he's been around such a long time, and you wonder why Fox and is it Newsweek or Time that's taking him on as a commentator as well.
Well, I think they do because he's, you know. To me, I don't have a problem with that, and I also think that to me, with all the people that appear on these shows who don't know anything,
right?
Here's somebody that's done it. I mean, you know, he certainly knows what he's talking about. He's run campaigns, and he may have an agenda, and he may have a point of view, mm-hmm. but he brings a tremendous amount of practical experience to the subject, and that makes it interesting to hear what he has to say, regardless of what you think about his politics. Most of the people who are analyzing these races don't know anything, so and haven't done it, and so. I think it's all the better to bring out people that have. I mean, it doesn't add anything to the debate if we've got partisan people from up there just sort of expressing, you know, doing the partisan spin. But if they have insights into what's going on based on their practical experience, I think that's something else.
Right. And so many, particularly, and I'm guilty, I watch these things all the time, the cable shows, when there's really almost nothing to say because
exactly.
There are no primaries going on. You got the same cast of characters, and so you're picking on one thing and going on and on and on and saying the same thing about it over and over. I finally reached a point where I said, I think I'm going to do something else tonight.
Well, sure. And most people, you know, the audience for these shows is up compared to where it was in the past, but it's still pretty small. I mean, you know, the number of people that listen to public radio, for example, dwarfs the audience of these cable shows. So that conversation is taking place within a relatively small share of the population who are consuming a lot more than their share of political news from not just cable TV, but from the internet and everything else.
Right.
I think it's a mistake. Sometimes we sort of think that somehow this is sort of the experience that the way the American people are experiencing the election, and they're into it up to their eyeballs.
Right.
And
that's just not
the case.
It's not true, huh? Let's go to Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I just want to make a comment that, no matter how the remaining primaries turn out, Barack Obama is more than likely going to have a delegate lead. And the only way that Hillary Clinton can get the nomination is for the superdelegates to basically steal it away from Barack Obama is the way a lot of people are going to look at it. And I think that's very dangerous. I just heard a figure on Hardball yesterday that there, in the last seven states, there were 1 million new registered Democrats, most of which went to Barack Obama. And I think that Hillary Clinton has kind of more of the old guard Democrats that would probably support a Democrat no matter who was the nominee. And a lot of these young people, I think, would be turned off, or the new registered people would be turned off, and maybe would just stay home. And I think we'd have run a serious risk of losing the election in November.
You know, this sort of gets to the heart of the electability debate, which is really unresolvable. It has so many nuances, and it's so speculative.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's the argument the Obama people would make, is that, you know, they're bringing new people into the process. They're reaching across party lines and bringing independents in. The argument the Clinton people would make is that, you know, Obama's going to lose a whole bunch of blue-collar Democrats that have tended to be, blue-collar voters have tended to be less predictable, less loyal to the Democratic Party than other groups. So you can sort of make either one of those arguments. I mean, how they offset each other and how it nets out, nobody knows. And so that's a problem for Hillary Clinton, in the sense that she's really basing her argument internally within the party on electability. And, you know, some people are going to be persuaded by that, but it's extremely difficult to make an open and shut, an ironclad case based on electability for either candidate.
Well, I think the African-American population, would is one of the most loyal groups to the Democrats, and I think for sure that they would not be real thrilled with the idea of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, again, that may be true, but you know, if a certain number of black voters are going to abandon, quote unquote, the Democratic Party in the fall, she's the nominee, and if young voters aren't going to turn out, how does that compare to the number of Reagan Democrats that are going to cross over and vote for McCain? Nobody knows the answer to these questions.
Right.
And then to try to parse that out on a state-by-state basis in the states where, you know, that are really going to matter in this election is just beyond anybody's analytical capability. And so, again, I think the bottom line is it makes it harder for her to make an ironclad case for electability in a way that overturns his lead among pledged delegates. And it's a reason why, you know, he's more likely to be the nominee than she is. Still.
Thanks, Mark, for the call. Email, Paul from Glendale. So what do you think? Is John Edwards holding out for a place on the ticket?
You know, I don't know what to think about John Edwards. I think he may be, you know, he may have big reservations about both candidates, and he may be torn. You know, you can be more Machiavellian than that and say, you know, what's the outlook he's looking for? But I don't know what's going on inside his head. He wouldn't be the only Democrat if, in fact, he was torn. He wouldn't be the only Democrat to be torn between the two of them. You know, they're Democrats. You know, Herb Kohl hasn't taken a position in this race. Russ Feingold has sort of said, even though he hasn't endorsed either candidate, he said he's going to vote for Obama essentially as a superdelegate because he won Wisconsin. But I've always had the sense from Russ Feingold that he was torn to some degree on a personal level between these two candidates. So, you know, that's there. I think there's something like 18 Senate Democrats that haven't endorsed either of their colleagues.
And Elizabeth Edwards wrote a real interesting column, I'm sure you read, about how actually, and she's right about this, we never got to know all of those other candidates very well. They were out of the race very soon.
Yeah, but, you know, that's life, I mean, in a way. I mean, the one, you know, everybody's complaint in 2004 was that Iowa decided everything because it was all over after Kerry won Iowa. And the complaint this time around for some people is that it's going on too long. So it's hard to complain in this cycle about certain people, you know, about candidates getting short shrift in a race that's gone on the way this has. It was just always the reality in this race that there were strong candidates, and there was only so much room in the race for these other candidates. They just it was always going to be very hard for them to compete with that, and so you know, that was inevitable. I think that there was going to be that winnowing at the front end of the process.
Yeah, Tona, is it from Milwaukee?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. I was saying that, you know, and a lot of this stuff is very hypocritical of a lot of media people regarding Jeremiah Wright. I think it's a smokescreen, And I think that people that were going to vote for Obama, they're going to vote for him anyway. I think that they're grinding at this, and really, it's old. It's old. He said what he said, and just because he said it, I could go to church there, but I wouldn't feel that same way. I love white people and America and all this other stuff, but I hear comments by other people, but that's not to say that I feel that same way.
Right.
And I just think it's a smokescreen, and I really think it's terrible. I think that Hillary Clinton, she jump on any bullet she can ride, and my question was this: does Hillary Clinton even go to church? She said she wouldn't sit upon her pastor for 20 years. Do she even go throughout the year?
Yeah, I think she does. I think she's quite religious, actually. There's another story about the group that she's involved in Washington, but we're going to have to leave it with that question. And Tona, thanks for the call. Craig, thank you very much, as always, for being with us. Carry on, sir.
It's my pleasure.
Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production on the Ideas Net.